The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us this morning as certified financial planner Jim Solnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
On today's show, we are going to get a recap on Jim's travels to Chicago and the Retirement Income Summit. I believe that's what it was called. We're also going to answer a couple of emails on a couple different topics. We also have a new segment we're going to start this week. We're going to talk a little bit about advisors who have gotten in trouble with regulatory authorities. We used to call this the Bad Boys segment, but we wanted something more gender neutral. We need to come up with something shorter than advisors who have gotten in trouble from regulatory authorities. But
and
we can't hear you either. So I know he's been out. He's out of practice. He's been out 2 weeks. So
testing.
Whoa, easy.
Is it working?
Oh, it's working.
That's loud.
It is loud. I think I have it still set up for the volume for Justin, who is sitting in your seat. I let Justin sit in your seat.
One hell of a big head, because my headphones
are stretched out.
Not that they're stretched out. I had to shrink them back down again. I put them on, and they were like hanging down on my neck. His head is so big. I had to make them small again, because I got a small head.
Different people are different sizes.
Yeah, well, he's got a big head. Mm-hmm. I listened to your show last week. You guys did a good job on the tax stuff.
Did you listen?
Not live. I listened to it recorded. Mm.
Checking up on us?
Just wanted to make sure you did your
job. I was
job.
A little disappointed because we didn't have nearly enough time to make fun of you.
I thought
we'd be able to get more in.
I didn't realize that was a segment on the show.
We're gonna dedicate more time to that next time.
Okay.
So welcome back from Chicago.
Thank you.
You must have made it back safely. Any disturbing events on the flight or anything?
I was on United and I was not dragged off, so... Mm-hmm.
Very nice.
I made it okay, although mm-hmm. I'd probably prefer to be dragged off so I could sue as well and settle within 2 weeks and mm-hmm. be able to retire. I'd take a broken nose and a missing tooth.
To be able to retire?
That guy had to have gotten at least 10 mil, if not more. I would do that.
I have no idea.
I would do that in a heartbeat. But I am back. I am trying to look up because I was telling Julia, she asked, how was Chicago? It was good, but do you remember when you went to Retirement Income mm-hmm. Summit with me about 3 years ago now, 4 years ago? I forget mm-hmm. when you came.
Yep.
We went to an Italian restaurant, and I told you that was a quaint little local Chicago.
Italian?
Mm-hmm. How do you say Italian?
Italian? I don't think they pronounce it with a hard I.
It's Italian. Eh? Italian?
Mm-hmm.
It's Italian.
I don't think it's Italian, just like it's not Iraq either. It's Iraq.
Jeez.
I'm just wondering.
2 minutes into the show and you, I'm Italian.
I missed you last week.
We get to the point I'm trying to make. Do you remember that Italian or Italian restaurant?
Wasn't it kind of like a diner thing, but it just happened to serve Italian? Was that the place or was it another place?
It's the place we went to
dinner. Oh, no. You know what that was? Wasn't that Maggiano's?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a chain.
I found that out.
There's one in Denver if you'd like to visit it.
I did not know that.
Mm-hmm.
So
I knew that. I knew it was a chain.
Well, all this time, I was telling Julia, I went there, I flew in the night before like I usually do. I went mm-hmm. to the hotel, I changed, and I went out to eat that night mm-hmm. to this Italian place.
Nice little quaint home style.
Yes, and I'm sitting in there like I always do, imagining and wondering if Al Capone ever ate there. And I just thought it was a real Italian Chicago restaurant.
It's real Italian.
Well, apparently it's not.
It's pretty good.
It's not bad, but it just burst my bubble. So the next day, mm-hmm. I had met some people there and two nice guys mm-hmm. from Minnesota.
Italians?
No, just mm-hmm. regular people. And we decided we're going to go out grab a bite to eat together mm-hmm. after the symposium.
Yeah.
So we start walking, and they said, hey, we're going to go back to the restaurant we went to the night before. It was really good. I says, all right, no problem. And they're walking towards this Italian place, mm-hmm. but on the other side of the road. And literally right across the street from this Italian place that I was at the night before and you came mm-hmm. with me, mm-hmm. they turned to go into their restaurant.
Right.
And I said, oh, I says, last night I ate there. And I pointed to the place and I said, if you want any real Chicago, authentic Italian food.
You said that to
yes,
them?
Yes, I thought it was a real Chicago restaurant.
And they looked at you
They looked at me like I had four heads.
Right,
and the older guy who was around my age, the other guy was Justin's age, he looked at me and he's like, Jim, that's a chain. I'm like, it is?
So they were about to take you to real Italian, right?
So I said, you mean Al Capone didn't eat there? So apparently I never knew. So that place is a chain.
It is. It's a good chain.
You never told me when I took you
there. I don't
there.
Remember you making a big deal about it being local Chicago homestyle Italian,
well,
though.
I was watching. I had recorded and just started watching that documentary from the Discovery Channel on the mob, and they're doing the Chicago mob now. It's an 8-part documentary.
Mm-hmm. And you were watching really close to see if Maggiano's
was
in there?
Well, I was just like, that's Al Capone. Maybe he was here. And it just, I had that
when
in
Al was
my
there,
head.
It was called something else. Maybe that's what.
Well, I think they had chain restaurants when Al was there.
What about the second one you went to? Was it better?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this was. It wasn't an Italian place. It was just a regular place.
Oh, okay.
But the food was uber good. It was good, and it must. I don't know if it was a chain or not. It didn't look like a chain. But man, those chains are sneaky.
What do you think they have to divulge the door? Oh, by the way, you're entering a chain.
Well,
what does it matter? It's either good or not good.
I'm not going there anymore. I got to find a real Chicago Italian place that Al Capone could have been at.
And Chicago steakhouses are really well known. That'd be a good place to go.
Across the street from the hotel we were at is that Ruth Chris Steakhouse.
Another chain.
I knew that was a chain because I hear it advertising on radio. But anyways, it was kind of a letdown as far as that goes.
Mm. What about, did you go to the cafe place with the breakfast? That's local. That's not a chain.
That was a local, right. For those who don't know, Chris and I the next morning I went to bed that night thinking I was eating at an authentic Chicago Italian place.
That was a little greasy spoon.
We went to a greasy spoon place, for breakfast.
Yeah.
Because the symposium, or the summit rather, Retirement Income Summit, I had been going for years. This thing has been around, I think, now for 7 or 8 years. I can't remember. I went, and then you came with me to one. But for the last two, I hadn't been. So this is the first time in 2 years. But they've improved it a lot. It's still at the Westin in Chicago, right on the riverfront. The classes were good. So they're kind of improving that. But they certainly don't tell you that the restaurant is a chain right down the road from where you'd be studying. Okay, so outside of that, it was good.
Now you know.
I know. So today on today's show, we've got I'm going to give an update to people on some of the new things that I took away, the new findings. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I discovered, and I broke the news to you already, is the correct pronunciation of Wade Fow's mm-hmm. name. We had been saying Wade Fow, Professor Wade Fow.
Don't say we.
You've said it. I never heard you
said
say...
I don't know. You used all these different versions, which then you were ridiculed by a listener. Remember?
Yes, he got upset.
Wrote to you that you didn't know how to pronounce his name.
Well, you don't.
It looks like foul.
It looks like foul. Yeah. It's not. It's foul.
That's what I just said.
Oh, I thought you said foe.
No. Oh. I said it looks like foul.
I used to say foe. Mm-hmm. It's one of the rare times that I mispronounced a word.
True.
On this show.
True.
But he was there. Wade was there. Mm-hmm. And he did a good presentation on those mortgages that we can't talk about.
Oh, those special mortgages only available to those 62 and older?
Correct, because the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority won't let me say their name. But he was there with his book. I got a copy of his book. But I had bought his book anyways. He's done tremendous research on those mortgages. And he showed us how they fit into a retirement plan. And he did a really good job. And then his book was being given away there. So I...
Free?
Yeah.
Did you bring me one?
I bought one for Justin. I didn't know you would want one.
What do you mean bought one? I thought you said they were free.
I did. I bought it. Bought it home.
You brought it?
If you want to be technical, that's what it meant. I bought it home.
You bought it home?
If you want to put...
How do you bought something that's free?
All right, I brought with an R.
Okay, yeah. I never noticed before. How long have I known you? I've never noticed you say bought. Seriously? Is that how you always say it or just...
Yes.
You bought it home?
I bought it home.
Huh.
In my suitcase.
And when you paid for something at the store, what had you done?
I paid for it. But if you want Justin's copy, you can have his. I haven't given it to him yet.
Oh, okay, sure. Well, I'd
I didn't think of getting you a copy.
Is it a large book?
No, it's not too long. I have the Kindle version. That's why I'm
if
willing
it's
to give
shortish,
it
shortish, I peruse it and then hand
absolutely.
It off to him.
It's very good. I mean, because you know him. Wade Fow is just renowned in our field, mm-hmm. retirement income planning. He is one of the leading researchers. And over the past 2 years, he has been leading the research on, as Chris says, these mortgages available to those over the age of 62.
Mm-hmm. Advertised sometimes by Henry Winkler.
Yes. And the reason why we don't say that anymore, although we can say the word mutual fund now
mutual
and
fund,
variable
yes.
annuity.
And variable annuity instead of the annuity whose returns
varies with that of the market. The Financial Industry Regulatory Authority listeners who regulate me, I am a registered representative. I am also an investment advisor representative. And I'm also a registered investment advisor. I'm all three. But because I still maintain a registered rep designation, and I don't know why I still have... Well, I know why. It has to do with my E&O insurance. And that's a whole issue I have with Cambridge. And I know they're listening to this. But they won't let me give it up because of that. But we don't do brokerage work anymore. We haven't done brokerage work here for goodness 8-9 years. We just don't sell mm-hmm. brokerage products. But I maintain that brokerage license for my errors and omission insurance purposes. And... because of that, we're regulated under the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. Mm-hmm. We're also regulated under the Securities and Exchange Commission through my investment advisor representative relationship with a corporate registered investment advisor. And we're regulated by the state of Colorado's Department of Securities through my personal registered investment advisory firm. So try following all that. I mean, it's confusing as hell. But it's FINRA that has the issue with the word. Mm-hmm. And they won't let a registered rep talk about said product.
Well, the VA mutual fund issue was theirs, but the mortgages that we can't
true.
Mention their name is actually not theirs.
Well, that was their recommendation. And Cambridge, the company that I have this registered rep affiliation with, they've taken a very hard-lined approach to FINRA's recommendation, and they won't even let us say the word, which I just think is insane. But that's neither here nor there. Wade is the leader in research on those mortgages, and he has really reversed my thinking on these mortgages. Has he reversed your thinking?
I don't know if it's really a reversal, but 'cause I was fairly convinced a few years ago without listening to Wade specifically They were quite confusing up front, and a lot of people had dismissed them. There's a lot of advisors who completely dismiss annuities of all kinds as well.
Correct.
They were maybe described some bad annuities at some point, and they just decided those are crap. I don't want to deal with those. Those are just a terrible idea.
They throw all annuities
throw them all
in.
Into yeah. there, you know. And then there's people who sell annuities who think other types of investment options are terrible because of their characteristics compared to an annuity. So they ignore all of those options, or maybe they're not even allowed to provide those other options. And those both views are very close-minded.
Absolutely.
I think there are different, and I hate to say products because it sounds like we're selling something, but there are different products either or investments. I wouldn't call an investment a product.
I wouldn't call an annuity an investment.
No, but there are products, annuities, and investments
correct.
That all have their place in a plan, in a financial plan.
Absolutely.
Depending on the circumstances of the person.
They're a tool.
They're just a tool, and tools have a job, and where people get into trouble is where they're using the wrong tool for the job.
Right.
And
you wouldn't use a plumber for brain surgery, and you wouldn't use a brain surgeon to unclog your sink.
Well, you might overpay. They could probably figure it out, though.
But
just saying.
You get the point I'm trying to make here.
You
have
point.
To use the right mm-hmm. tool for the mm-hmm. job.
Yep.
So anyways, Wade was there. It was very good. Mm-hmm. So was the Social Security woman, and her name's
Mary Beth Franklin.
Mary Beth Franklin.
She was there. She was tweeting from the summit.
Oh, you follow her tweets?
I do.
Oh. So she was there, as always, with good Social Security info. I think the big problem that she had after the major change a year and a half ago, not much has changed.
Right.
So it's hard to talk about the same
boring.
Stuff.
No.
But I like it because you sit there for an hour and a half and test yourself as they're talking. Yes, I remember that. Yes, I remember that. Mm-hmm. So it helps. And so that was a good class. As always, the steel show, or as far as I'm concerned, Michael Kitsis. The man is just brilliant. He is just so smart. He puts on such a compelling presentation. No notes, no nothing. It's all from his head. He did one on sequence of return risk that I called Justin after, and I said, I just listened to Michael Kitsis essentially talk for an hour and a half supporting our entire retirement planning process. I mean, that wasn't the point of his presentation, but we have developed our process to protect clients from one of the biggest risks in retirement, and they don't even understand it, sequence of return risk. Mm-hmm. And he talked so in-depth on sequence of return risk, but of course, how can you help solve for it? And again, putting a floor in for expenses that must be covered, which is what we do. He called it an annuity floor, not in the sense he said that you're going to go out and buy an annuity, but pensions, Social Security, and income annuities mm-hmm. are annuity payments.
Right.
So put in an annuity floor and then bucket your investment assets. And then he did get into the guardrail approach, which is an approach we don't talk about on here because I don't do it. But I thought that might be a compelling show one day to teach people a different approach to retirement planning that we don't do mm-hmm. that's receiving a lot of press or a lot of positive attributes. I don't like the approach, but some people do. But it's called the guardrail approach or the ceiling floor approach. We could talk about it on a future show. But it was very refreshing to listen to someone at the knowledge and depth level of Kitsis essentially confirming our whole process. And it made me realize, okay, we're doing it. And I feel personally we're doing a good job and the right job for retirement planning, which is totally different than accumulation planning. And he said the same thing. Those advisors who are using accumulation rules on a distribution portfolio are going to cause, or could cause, it's not going to happen, but could very well cause clients to run out of money.
And if they have enough clients, there will be some that will happen too.
Eventually.
Case, because just the odds, just the math of the deal. If you've only got two or three, maybe you'll be lucky that those two or three succeed, even though you're using inappropriate techniques for the distribution phase of someone's life. Just like people can get lucky, right? You can get lucky. And the chances, especially if you have a lot of assets acquired, you have to really mess things up to a tremendous degree to have a complete failure of your retirement plan.
But not with sequential risk.
But with what happens, though, is it's stealthy. It's sneaky. What will happen is, even though there's not a fail, if you have given up spendable money that you could use to go on vacation and to entertain your grandkids and to buy the RV and all those kinds of things, that's a loss. You know, that's a loss to you personally that you'll never regain. So even though you have to kind of think of how advisors consider a failed plan is you run out of money. But it failed way before that, in my opinion, when your assets and your other resources have dwindled to the point where you're restricting what you'd like to do. Right there, you're already losing. Right there, you're already losing. And that's the stealthy part of the pain of someone who hasn't planned for it properly. And that can happen before the plan mathematically fails. So I think that's overlooked by a lot of people.
It is. And that was his whole point. Most advisors are totally missing. Most people saving for retirement, not saving, but most people already in retirement fail to understand sequential return risk. And again, to even hear him saying you don't want all the money in the markets, you can't. And that's why he was saying you need to put in what he called an annuity floor. You and I call it the minimum dignity floor. And we cover it with what we call secure income. But he just totally, totally supported that approach. And this is an approach I thought of years ago. It's just you sit around as an advisor and you say, I'm going to specialize in retirement planning. Well, you just don't leave it there and say, okay, let's print on my business cards. I'm a retirement planner. You actually start bettering yourself and studying and learning. And that's what you and I did. We taught ourselves Social Security. We taught ourselves all about annuities. That's why we don't hate them anymore. You said, and I remember you and I went to a presentation in Fort Collins about 4 years ago with a Texas Tech researcher. Fink is his name, Mike Fink. Remember him? Mm-hmm. Professor Fink, F-I-N-K-E, Fink. Is that Finky or Finky?
It's Fink.
Fink. Mm-hmm. He does a lot of research with Wade, Professor Fow. And remember he talked in at CSU. Was it CSU we went to?
No, and there was another guy actually from Texas Tech that starts with an S, Salter or Sals. Something. He was there as well.
Yeah, he was there as well. Yeah. I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
But point is, you and I learned all this. We had to change our train of thought. There are so many advisors, as Kitsis was saying, who don't change their thought on distribution portfolios. And many of them, perhaps, don't even understand sequential risk themselves, Chris. And it's because a lot of the software we use just always puts in everything is going to be beautiful, everything is going to be fine. Now, you can start putting in some sequential risk using Monte Carlo simulations. But again, as he pointed out, Monte Carlo does a very poor job of identifying black swan events and adjusting for them. But also, as you regularly point out on this show, do you want to be, okay, you have an 80% chance of success. Do you want to be the 20% chance where it's not success?
Even if they run it and they say you've got a 95% chance of success, you have to recognize there's still a 5% chance of failure. And the question becomes, what will your life be like if you're one of the 5%? And if that advisor has 100 clients, if he's running them all on 95% probabilities, 5%, 5 of that 100 is going to fail.
But as Mike said, what changes in that is, what if the client lives a little longer? Or what if the returns are a little lower or inflation is a little higher? The issue becomes, especially in the case of clients living longer, success, as I've always pointed out, means you could have as little as a dollar left. And success really isn't successful anymore if you're not dead at that point in time. So again, it comes into utilizing what he had called the annuity floor, but you and I call the minimum dignity floor, and covering it with secure income. But anyways, that's not what I wanted to get into on the whole summit. I have notes here. You'd be proud of me. Look at that.
Notes?
It's on the iPad. Wow. I actually typed them right into that. So I didn't write them out.
You typed and they are just longhand notes?
No, I typed them right into my iPad.
You have a keyboard?
Yeah, it's not on here now, but I have a keyboard attachment for it.
Pretty high tech there. You didn't just use that thing to hold your papers?
No.
Wow.
So when we come back, folks, I'm going to talk about a few tidbits. Some of these I've already reviewed with Chris. None of them I've reviewed with our listeners. I think our listeners will learn something from some of these tips I got from the Retirement Income Summit. And then if we have time later on today, we're going to answer an email question from a listener in Alaska. And then we're going to start a new segment on our show. What are we calling it again?
Bad brokers? Right now, it's advisors who have gotten in trouble with regulatory authorities.
We will come up with a shorter title than that. Maybe we'll get the acronym for that.
Something. So that music means we're at a break here. When we come back from this break, we're going to hear one of the top songs from 1935. This top hit from 1935 features the brother of a well-known crooner slash movie star from that era. So we'll find out who that is and what song that is after this short break.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. That is in a little gypsy tea room, which became a hit for Bob Crosby and his orchestra. That's Bob, not Bing. Bob was the youngest sibling in the Crosby family, which consisted of seven brothers and sisters. Bob and his orchestra were known for their unique sound that combined traditional jazz and older tunes with the popular swing big band sound of the 30s and 40s.
I will say Bob did not have as good a PR firm as Bing.
Because you didn't hear much about him?
I never heard of Bob. You ever heard of Bob? I never heard of Bob.
I knew there was a Bob. I haven't listened to a lot of Bob's music. Although he formed a smaller band using members from his big orchestra called the Bobcats. I haven't heard of them either.
I just think Bing had a much better PR firm
than Bob. I think his parents helped him out, named him Bing. Is his real name Bing, by the way? I need to look that up. I think it is.
Was his first name Bada Bing? Bada? Last name, middle name Bing?
Yeah.
Bada Bing Crosby.
Mm-hmm.
We just call him Bing for short. Okay. Are we ready?
Well, I think so. I'm pretty much ready.
All right. So
back to our update from the Retirement Income Summit in Chicago.
2017 Retirement Income Summit. I'm just going to, folks, go through a few of these things. I typed them all into my iPad. Chris has been hounding me for writing notes in this day and age. So I typed everything into the little note section of my said iPad. Very convenient that they have a note section. And I'm going to just kind of review some of the things that stuck out at me. And I'll give you, Chris, a chance to opine on some of them. Like I said before the show, I did go over some of them with you. So I think some of them are going to be repeats for you. Okay, the one thing that jumped out, and we have talked about this on several shows, Chris. We talk about cream and coffee. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And when we talk about cream and coffee, longtime listeners will know, we are trying to describe to you the visual of what happens when you take a traditional IRA that has traditionally has in a traditional IRA pre-tax money, money that the government has yet to subject to income tax, and you mix into it a little bit of post-tax money. And we use the visual of cream and coffee, with cream being the post-tax money or money that's already been taxed, being mixed into a IRA with a bunch of pre-tax money or black coffee. And we talked about that when a little bit of cream gets into a cup of coffee, it spreads throughout that coffee. And separating that cream or separating that after-tax money from the coffee or the pre-tax money is very hard. Mm-hmm. But we gave people some suggestions on how to do it. One of them was to take the IRA that you might have pre- and post-tax money in and move it to a 401k. Mm-hmm. By law, you cannot move post-tax money in an IRA to a 401k. So if you go and move that IRA, and we had this discussion not too long ago with a gentleman who was trying to do something similar to that, I think, moving money from a Prudential account to a Fidelity account. When you move the 401k to an IRA, an IRA to a 401k, the custodian will not accept after-tax money. You actually have to sign off that you're not transferring after-tax money. So the only thing left in the IRA is after-tax money.
So essentially what happens here is the 401k overrides the normal pro rata rule. Essentially, they say, because normally when you take money out of an IRA that's cream and coffee mixed together, it comes out as if you were taking a spoon and dipping it into that cup of cream and coffee, and it comes out mixed pro rata proportionately by what was, how much coffee versus cream that you put in there. But the 401k overrides that. That's one of the few ways that can be overridden, because the normal rules, and you have to play by the rules if you have an IRA, otherwise you get in trouble by the IRS, they determine the rules on distribution from those mixed cream and coffee IRAs as coming out pro rata, unless there's an override. And that's what this essentially is. This is an override. So those of you who have heard us discuss the pro rata rule, that normally would take place as you moved it from the IRA somewhere outside of the IRA. Here, though, the 401k is essentially has a higher level of authority, if you will, and they block the cream from entering and push it back into the cup, accepting all the coffee, and now it's separated.
Exactly. The big thing I just want to mention is Natalie Choate, who was one of the presenters at the Retirement Income Summit. Natalie is from the fine state of Massachusetts. She is a very experienced estate planning attorney, but she specializes in retirement accounts. So she's very, very knowledgeable on retirement accounts. She essentially wrote, Ed Slott calls her book The Bible. Her book on retirement account distribution rules it reads like a textbook. It's a very deep, deep read. But she was there, and I simply want to report to everyone, did confirm the viability of that strategy. There are people out there posting or writing that the strategy isn't going to work for one reason or another, and she has confirmed it will work, and it will work fine. It is a viable, viable strategy. So she did confirm that. Another thing that she pointed out, which is one of these obscure tidbits of information most people will never need. Most people will never need it. Advisors, because we deal with multiple people, some advisors such as our firm, we have well over 100 clients. We've got a lot of people we work with. So she pointed out that if you are over the age of 70 and a half and going through a divorce, so you are subject to required minimum distribution rules. And during the divorce, your ex-spouse or soon-to-be ex-spouse is awarded a portion of your retirement account. And it's awarded, it's signed, it's agreed to from the courts. It just hasn't been separated yet. So let's just say you were married in 2017, over the age of 70 and a half, going through a divorce. And in 2017, the courts award and you agree and everything is signed, your ex will receive half of your IRA. Mm-hmm. But the actual account doesn't get separated until the following year. When you determine your required minimum distribution, you have to use your December 31st account value of that previous year. You are allowed to separate that out when the account gets separated for the divorce purpose, for required minimum distribution.
So even though on December 31st of 2017, it hadn't been physically separated yet, the award had been laid down by the court prior to that.
It's not yours anymore.
Right. Normally, you would have to pay and you'd have to withdraw or distribute from your IRA an RMD based on that December 31st, 2017 value. That would be your RMD for 2018. But this rule is essentially saying we're going to recognize the fact that the law had split it, even though you physically hadn't gotten around to separating it yet, and will allow you to split it and just do the RMD that is for your part that's left behind. So this, it's almost like a retroactive fix here.
And I would have guessed that isn't the rule. This was one of the new things.
I would have guessed you had to physically have
physically separated. That's how I would have assumed it to be. So it surprised me when she reported it the way she did. So that was one of those little tidbits that I hadn't known but did gather from it. Another thing that I thought she made a good point on that was interesting. She said there are four modes to take distribution of your RMDs. Have you ever heard of it worded that way?
Four modes?
She called it modes. Let's just say there are four manners, four ways of taking RMDs. Do you know what the four would be? I'll give you a hint. The first one is just take a cash distribution.
Mm-hmm.
She said, but there are four ways to satisfy, four modes, four manners, four ways.
So the second, you could distribute assets themselves other than cash.
Okay.
So if you have something in there in pieces you could bring out or so that's two. You could QLAC.
Perfect. Very right? good.
You could make a distribution directly to a charity under a QLAC qualified longevity.
It's not a QLAC, it's a QCD.
QCD, that's what I meant. That's what I meant.
Well, you were right with the acronym. Right. Qualified Longevity Annuity Contract.
Right. But what I was, talking about is a QCD, right, being able to send money out to a charity in the form
qualified
of a QCD.
Qualified charitable distribution.
And that satisfies your RMD, or at least partly would, it's depending on how much you put out. So there's a fourth.
You'll never get. I didn't get it either.
I'll never get it.
I had the three you mentioned. I knew you could do the fourth one, but I never really considered it a different mode. To me, it's a cash distribution.
Oh, and they're calling it a different mode?
She calls it a different mode.
Boy, I don't know.
Tax withholding.
Oh.
Part of your RMD can go to the IRS as a tax withholding, and it counts as the RMD.
Right.
And you could theoretically, she said, take your entire RMD and send it to the government in a 100% tax withholding, and it still satisfies your RMD. To me, that's just a subset of a cash distribution.
It's a cash distribution that you are directing to the IRS rather than taking it yourself.
That's correct.
So I agree with you. I wouldn't really call that a fourth mode. I think that's mode 1A.
When she said there were going to be four, I was like, okay, cash, assets, and then I had to think for a minute, and I was like, QCD. And I could not think of the fourth one. But yes, you can send your money to the IRS. I could also send it to my church. I could send it to King Supers for my grocery bill. I mean, it's so I don't know. I didn't argue with
three. In our world, there's three.
There's three. In Natalie's world, there's four. Okay. She's a hell of a lot smarter than we are.
True.
Okay. So I thought these were some interesting approaches that she took. One thing that I knew and I wrote down just to tell our listeners because I knew we were going to talk about this. When you take a distribution as an asset, and you can do that not only for your required minimum distribution, you can do it to affect a direct or indirect rollover. But whatever comes out has to be the same asset going back in. So if you are going to take out an investment from your IRA and put it in a new IRA, let's just say you're going to do it as a 60-day rollover. Ed from the Ed Slot Group talks about this all the time. And he says if you have an investment in there, and he says that investment can be a stock, it can be a bond, it can be a mutual fund, but not so much a mutual fund, but a stock or a bond or gold, he puts, you can request the actual stock certificate. You can request the actual bond, assuming it's not an electronic bond, and you find fewer and fewer actual bearing coupon bonds. But or the gold, he says, you can take the physical gold out of your IRA. But what you can't do during the 60 days that you have it is sell it. Mm-hmm. You can't sell it during that time period and then move cash into the IRA. You can sell it, but then you have to replace it with an identical. So if you took 100 shares of a stock or an ounce of gold out of your IRA, and during that, and you're going to do it as a 60-day rollover, and during that 60-day period when you're opening the new IRA or you're just trying to get it into the other IRA, something happens and you decide, I've got to sell this investment. So you grab that ounce of gold that was distributed and you run down to some pawn shop in town and you say, here, I've got to sell this gold. Let's just say the market is crashing or something. Now you have cash. Mm-hmm. You can't move the cash back into an IRA. You have to move 1 ounce of gold. So you still have to replace it with an ounce of gold or it counts as a distribution. And that was her point. If any of your clients had taken a distribution of an asset, let's say they're trying to satisfy, she said, their RMD with a distribution of an asset, and they take too much. And they took the asset out, and they ended up selling it while they owned it, only to realize, wow, I took $1,000 more out. You can't take that remaining $1,000 and roll it into an IRA. You would have to take that $1,000 and buy whatever that asset was and put the physical asset in. Did I explain that right? Do you understand that part? Okay. So she was just confirming that. I had always known that. I knew if we said the word asset, people might start thinking and scheming. And I just wanted to point out, assets out, assets in. Mm-hmm. Wax on, wax
off. Can't be asset out, money in.
It can't be money out, asset in either.
Correct.
You can't take money out and say, oh, I'm going to buy this.
Something and then stick it in there.
And then stick it in there.
Correct.
Okay. Here was something that I think she made a really good point on. This one I had never thought of. Hmm. So it too was a good point Natalie made. And we have talked in the past on this. We every now and then get either email questions when we used to go live in Northern Colorado on KFKA. We haven't done a live show out of Greeley in a long time. For iTunians who don't know what we mean, the Retirement and IRA Show was actually and still is a locally produced, I guess you could say, financial education radio show in Northern Colorado, Chris. It used to be live all the time, and every Saturday morning, Chris and I would be in Greeley, Colorado, broadcasting live for our, originally started as a half-hour show, then it went to a one-hour show, then it went to a two-hour show. I've been trying to take it to 3 hours, but a certain person, who shall remain nameless, who's staring at his cell phone right now, doesn't want to take it to 3 hours, and since he knows how to use all the equipment, he wins. But we have talked about this in the past. Every now and then, Chris, we get people who own real estate and IRAs or want to know how can they get real estate into their IRAs. You done?
Yeah. Sometimes I get urgent messages.
You're texting.
No, I didn't text back.
All right. Anyways, you can take over because I pointed to you, but you weren't paying attention.
They're asking how you can get real estate into your IRA. So and it is possible.
Every once in a while we
but
get...
we usually don't advise
it. We don't advise it.
Because it's fraught with a minefield of issues.
But here is an issue we have never talked about. We have talked about a lot of issues of owning real estate in an IRA. But we have talked about the difficulty of required minimum distributions. If you have... And these are the industry and the IRS calls them hard-to-value assets. Mm-hmm. And that's an IRS term.
And the normal minefield essentially just gets doubled, in my opinion, when you reach RMD age, when you have a hard-to-value asset that's in a big chunk like a piece of real estate. So people who end up going down that path, I usually try to encourage them, get the heck out of that thing when you get to RMD age. Otherwise, you're going to run into the issues that we're talking about.
Or if you have not even substantial enough, if you have another IRA that you can take the distribution from. Because the initial distribution is 3.7% of your IRA's value. Mm-hmm. So let's just say you have $1 million. You know, everybody uses round numbers. So we're just going to say $1 million IRA. And if all $1 million is in real estate, now you can run into some difficulty.
Now you've got a problem.
But if you have $500,000 in a piece of real estate and another $500,000 in a regular, by that we mean stock, bond, mutual fund, ETF,
cash style
investment, you can satisfy the RMD of the $500,000 home, Chris, by taking it out of the $500,000 investment account.
Agreed.
But the problem becomes this. What if you have $1 million IRA all in real estate? Or what if you have a $300,000 IRA all in real estate?
Mm-hmm.
Now you're 70 and a half and you have to take an RMD. We have talked about this on the past. I know you know where I'm going with this. Before you go there, in the past, what did we used to tell people they had to do?
To do what?
Take the RMD. How would they do it if they had all real estate?
Well, they're going to have to give out of the IRA a piece of that real estate.
Or exactly.
They could distribute the whole thing, but of course then the whole thing becomes a taxable event. So you don't want to do that. If you only want to take out the RMD, you essentially have to carve off in that first year about 3.7% of that real estate and deed it out. So now that real estate is held by two entities, 96% roughly by your IRA and the other 4% by you.
Exactly. And that's how Ed Slott used to explain it. Well, you would have to deed out. You'd have to get an attorney to you know, create these deeds and break it up so it adds cost, all of which has to be covered by the IRA, not by you. Becomes increasingly difficult if there's no cash in the IRA. But that's how hard-to-value assets would be done. And there's some people now who are trying to put even more hard-to-value assets in there. They're putting in limited liability corporations, private partnerships. We had that emailer who was going to buy a limited partnership in his IRA of a company that owned properties throughout his hometown. Remember that?
Yeah.
And we told him there could be a problem if he actually went to one of the places his IRA owned and either ate there or partied there or did whatever that venue was offering. So we've talked about this in the past, but what she pointed out was this, and it really made me scratch my head saying, I never thought about this before. Because even Ed Slott would just say, okay, what you're going to have to do is deed out 3.7% of the home. And he said the same thing. Now you have the majority of the home is owned by the IRA. In your case, you used round numbers. Mm-hmm. You said 96% owned by your IRA, 4% owned by you. She pointed out something that when I told you, you went, I never thought of it. And I think she's right. Because as you said, and I'm going to let you tell listeners what we're getting at, you said she's on the one hand, estate planning attorneys use this strategy all the time. On the other hand, they're saying, oh, never mind, it doesn't apply here. But what she wanted to point out, listeners, is if you have and you do that and you deed out 3.7% of the real estate in your IRA to satisfy the first year's RMD, Chris, if you went and took that 3.7% and tried to sell it, would you get the full value for that asset?
No, because nobody wants to buy 3.7% of a piece of real estate.
Exactly.
So the market value is going to plummet on that.
And that was her point.
Yeah.
She said, let's just use $1 million as a round number again. And you have $1 million in real estate. You have to take out $37,000 from that IRA.
Yep.
If you do not have $37,000 in that IRA or another IRA to physically take out, yes, you have to. The solution was deed out the 3.7% ownership stake. That's how we came up with $37,000, 3.7% of $1 million piece of real estate in an IRA. As she said, that $37,000 deed you have is no way near worth $37,000.
No.
And she said, did you satisfy your RMD? She takes the point, no, you haven't. You undertook your RMD. You took 3.7% of the home out, but that asset you have is not worth that. And this is a strategy estate planners use all the time.
They do, because sometimes the technique, they want to reduce the value of the estate. So they'll actually take an asset like a big farm or something and chop it up into a bunch of little pieces. And you'd think at first that the little pieces would just be worth, you know, if it's a 10% piece, it's worth 10% of the total. But that's not true because of what Jim is talking about. That little 10% piece is very illiquid, very difficult to sell.
And no one's going to want
nobody,
it.
Nobody wants it. So the argument is its true value is much
worthless.
Less.
Worth a lot less.
Yeah. And same issue would be here. My argument to her, not argument, but my question back to her would have been, so what if we give out 20% of it and we say, well, it's only worth about 3.7% because of the reduction due to the illiquidity.
That's where
is that a way for me to get a bunch of it out and only pay tax on a little piece of it?
That's a great way to say, hey, I'm going to distribute 20% and say it's only worth 3.7%. Mm-hmm. That's essentially what she's saying.
Right.
The mirror opposite of what she's saying. That is a very compelling argument. I'm going to take this up at the Ed Slot Group when I go there next month, because she got me thinking on this. She's mm-hmm. right. It's not worth 3.7%.
Nope. So that music means we're at a break. When we come back from this break, we're going to hear the top song from this week back in 1977.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show.
I don't understand Spanish, but I think that's Hotel California.
It is. I just happen to be playing the Spanish version in honor of yesterday.
Cinco de Mayo?
Yes, yesterday was Cinco de Mayo. Or, not technically. Today it's Uno de Mayo. Or Dos. So anyway, we're recording this on May 2nd.
But it's playing on the 5th?
It's playing on the 5th. No, it's playing on the 6th.
Ah.
So, yesterday.
Yesterday. Gotcha.
In radio time was Cinco de Mayo. And I happened to run across that version of it. That's by the Gypsy Kings. It's actually a really awesome version. But, and tons of people have redone Hotel California. This, of course, was an Eagles tune from back in 1977. Hit number one back in 1977. Would go on to win Grammy Awards for Record of the Year.
Oh.
So that's an iconic song there.
It is.
But that was Gypsy Kings doing the Spanish version in honor of Cinco de Mayo.
Very good. Very good.
You like that?
Okay. So
to mix it up a little.
Should we say to people why we do this? Or are you going to say
no.
that?
No. Okay. We can do that later.
We'll do that later. So the only other thing I want to wrap up is where we left off, because during mm-hmm. the commercial break, which is not really commercial break for us when we're doing the recording, we just stop and stretch and go to the bathroom and come back in.
Well, then it allows the radio people to insert their commercials.
Correct. So while that was happening, we continued on with this really unique thought that Natalie Choate mentioned during the Retirement Income Summit. And that is, when you deed out, she used real estate, but any hot to value asset that's being distributed for RMD purposes by sending out, whether it's ownership units in an LLC, parts of the deed of real estate, whatever hot to value or illiquid asset you have in your IRA and you're somehow trying to transfer out the item of value, she feels, because of the liquidity discount, which is a viable strategy estate attorneys do all the time, they take liquid assets, put them either in family limited partnerships, family LLCs, specifically to then say to the government, we can't sell these, we can't trade these. They were very liquid asset, now they're an illiquid asset. Right.
Liquid means you can sell it easily without right. great loss of value. Illiquid means you're kind of stuck in it. You can't sell it easily. So when something's illiquid, it becomes less valuable.
Exactly. Or when something in a whole is broken up and you're only selling mm-hmm. a piece, who wants to own 5% of a piece of real estate?
Right.
So her point is, when you take money out of an IRA, not the money, but you're transferring the actual asset or a deed or something, and you're saying, I'm just using a dollar amount here. Oh, my RMD is $5,000, so I'm going to take out $5,000 worth of this asset, and now you have 3%. 4%, 5% of the asset outside of the IRA, the remaining is inside, you're not going to get that value. It's not worth that. So she thinks you are under reporting or undertaking your RMDs initially. But you pointed out during the break the opposite, and you tried talking about this before the break, the opposite happens initially. That you might be able to justify saying, look, I'm sending 20% of my real estate out because let's just say there's $1 million IRA. And
you could deed out 20% of that.
We're making 20% up. It mm-hmm. might be 5%,
right.
might be 8%, might be 26%. We're just saying you could deed out more than the 3.7 and say this is only worth 37,000. 3.7% of $1 million is 37,000. But if you could justify that you have to distribute 100,000 because of this valuation discount, that's how. So you might be sending out 10% of the asset, but it's only worth, because of the valuation discount, that to me is a viable, defendable strategy mm-hmm. until about half of the IRA is right. distributed. Then you're going to run into the opposite issue. And that can be that the value of the IRA now is dropping. If you now have 70% of the asset outside of the IRA, the value of the asset inside of the IRA is not worth the same anymore. Mm-hmm. It's worth less.
Now, a lot of this is actually just generating a lot of the criticism we have for holding these types of assets in IRAs is that you're going to constantly be facing this valuation nightmare, because for these hard to value assets, you've got to create a value that's justifiable to the IRS every year on as of December 31st to determine what the RMD value will be for the following year. And so you're constantly going to be asking, in our weird example, it's a piece of real estate, which isn't all that weird, because a lot of people want or heard about the ability to put real estate in certain IRAs, you're going to be, I would say the advantages you might face in such a thing could easily be eaten up in the costs of constantly valuing that real estate, first of all, because this isn't going to be a cheap appraisal that you're going to do. It's not going to be something you can just go look up on Zillow or something like that when you're starting to chop the property up into pieces. It's going to have to be a professional, full-blown assessment. And then you've got the issue of If you make a mistake, you know, the threat, if you will, the risk that something's gone wrong, and then you're going to face these gigantic penalties from the IRS, you need to factor all of that stuff in before you decide this is what you really right. want to do with your IRS.
And that was her point. She said this has never been taken up by the IRS. Mm-hmm. She was just thinking of this through her estate planning eyes, saying, wait a minute, if we're taking a discount valuation because of the illiquidity of something, these RMDs aren't right.
Well, and this hasn't come up yet because real estate in an IRA is a fairly new phenomenon. As more and more people have done this, then there's going to be more and more cases that are going to come up in front of the IRS, and they will eventually deal with this. I just hope it's not you, listener, that they choose to determine the you know how this actually is going to work, because it could be very, very messy, very, very expensive.
And the thing is, beginning 2 years ago, they started demanding that custodians report to them hard-to-value assets. Mm-hmm. So they know whose IRAs are hard-to-value. Yep. They know the value of those hard-to-value assets. They don't know what the assets are.
They at least know what you're claiming is the
but
value.
Right. And I think we're going to start to see things similar to this with hard-to-value assets.
And while they're in there, there has been... And I think some justifiable advice that's been given by several people in the field that maybe just a simple Zillow valuation would work for the whole piece of real estate.
It
say
won't.
Something like a house. For the house, it would until you get to the RMDs.
And you start breaking it up.
Zillow isn't going to value 97 or 96% of your house. It's the whole house. If it was owned by one entity, this might be the justifiable value. Once you're off into chopping it up, now you're in a whole new world of complexity, which you're not going to be able to just look up a simple valuation on the assessor's website of your county or at Zillow or some other, or get a real estate agent.
And don't forget also, how at that point do you sell the asset? She never talked about this, but my own brain, which is quite knowledgeable on IRAs, is thinking, wait a minute, you cannot be in cohorts with your IRA. So if you own half the house and the IRA owns the other half of the house and you guys are going to sell it together, that's self-dealing, in my opinion.
Well, if the IRA is selling it to you, that would be a problem.
But the IRA has to be represented by the custodian of the IRA during mm-hmm. the negotiation phase of the real estate.
Correct.
You cannot be doing it all. If you own half the house and the IRA owns half the house, you got to sit there and look at the seller and say, I will sell you my half for this price. Mm-hmm. But the custodian of the IRA has to negotiate what they want.
For their half.
And you can't.
And you can't
talk to them.
And you, as the individual, can't pay any of the fees for the transaction involving the half owned by the IRA. We could go on and on. And
the IRA cannot sell you the other half of the house to make this easy.
Correct.
And you can't sell your half of the house to the IRA.
Now, you could distribute the whole thing out, the rest of it out to yourself. You do have that power.
Correct.
But then that half of the house... taxable in that year.
So see the nightmare this is becoming. Mm-hmm. And anyways, all this from the Retirement Income Summit, listening to her point out the valuation discount. Mm-hmm. I had never thought of
that. Did the whole audience gasp, or did they not really understand the depth
of the
issue?
A lot of the people there had no clue about this. Yeah. I told you at lunch, people were later saying, wow, all this stuff I learned. And I'm not disputing that. I'm happy they were there. There were about 390-something people there out of 600,000 or whatever it is, advisors in the world. I mean, so at least they're trying. Anyone who goes to a seminar, to me, needs a pat on their back, not just because I go constantly, but... I would say, out of those of us who understood what she was saying, I wasn't collectively gasping, but I was sitting there thinking, wow, and my brain just starts going down all these rabbit holes. What if this? What if that? I never thought of this, never thought of that. But it comes back to the reasons why I don't want people to own real estate inside an IRA, especially after RMDs begin. But not only that, I don't know why you would want to anyways. You're going to lose all the tax advantages of owning real estate. No step up in basis, no depreciation, just it's all gone. You lose it all. Everything becomes tax. Jim, houses are appreciating so much. I want to capture that. As what? Income?
Right.
That's what you're going to be taxed at. You're not going to get taxed at capital gains rates. Yeah.
And a lot, if it's a second home or for you or something, there's a point at which that second home might become your primary home. And then you get the benefits of
But
the
now
tax
you're
advantages.
Screwed. You can't do
you
it.
You can't do it if it's in the IRA.
Your IRA owns it.
They might say, well, this is an extra house for me. It's not a rental property. It's just my second home, and I've got it in there. Well, for a lot of people, that second home becomes
their
primary home.
Cannot
and,
do that.
And once it's your primary, if the IRA isn't involved, once it's your primary home for a couple of years, then you get it treated as your primary home for tax purposes when you sell it.
And you have,
and you can't do that when it's encumbered inside
your
IRA.
You either have to distribute the entire house as taxable income to you in that year, and now you have the house, but you have a massive tax bill, or you have to sell the home to a arm's length, third party, and the trustee of the IRA
These
sells it.
These are the things those folks that are, you know who came up with this idea?
Real estate agents,
because they kept facing people trying to convince them to buy real estate, and they found that their
money was all
tied up in retirement accounts. So somebody thought, well, how the heck can we get to convince these people they can actually use the money in their IRA to buy real estate from us so we can earn a commission? That is why this whole story was created in the first place. It wasn't created because, ooh, it would be a great thing to have real estate inside my IRA. It was a, wow, I'd really like to buy that real estate, or I'd really like to sell that person that real estate, but the only money they have is tied up in this darn IRA. We've got to figure out a way around that.
Yep.
And then they didn't think about or consider or care about all these side ramifications and side effects that you're going to deal with, this tax nightmare down the road.
Yeah, and planning and distributions and all of that.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Okay, so that is my update from the 2017 Retirement Income Summit. With that in mind, do we have time to start our new segment, which unfortunately we have not come up with a catchy little name. It's still advisors who got in trouble with the regulators. And that acronym is pronounced OGGITWR. And it doesn't flow off a tongue.
Bad Boys was good back when we used the Bad Boys song, but since we're not using a different song, that doesn't seem to fit as well. I was trying to think of the song we're going to use is from Underdog, so I was trying to think of some kind of underdog thing, but I didn't. Did Underdog have one particular nemesis? Did he have one enemy that he dealt with regularly? I thought it was just random people. But
it was random other dogs.
I need to go look and see if there was, maybe you call it Bad Dogs.
Bad Dogs, yeah.
The Bad Dogs segment.
I get most of this from Investment News, and they call it regulatory action.
That's not very exciting.
That's not very exciting
either. Plus, it doesn't tie into Underdog.
How much time do we have?
We have 10 minutes.
Plenty of time. So, this is a new segment. Now, let me just tell people how this new segment's going to work. We're probably not going to do it every week, maybe once a month, once every 6 weeks or so. As I do all my readings and do all my travels, I come across advisors and brokers who got in trouble. And with the regulators, some have been arrested, some have been barred, some have been barred and arrested. There's a whole mixture. What I want to do, Chris, is not just summarize the article or the proceedings. I want to tell people what were the red flags.
Right. This is more, it isn't to point someone out and ridicule them personally. It is more to give an illustration or an example of something you might face, and you want to protect yourself from these types of things.
Exactly.
And by us bringing it to your attention, you'll know what to look for in
what
the future.
What to look for, exactly. So,
when in this world the headlines read of those whose hearts are filled with greed, and rob and steal from those who need to right this wrong with grinding speed, go underdog.
So that's our new theme song. It's got to be our best theme song yet.
Probably. I hope we'll have to hear from people if they can actually understand the words, because the words are actually pretty funny.
Oh, if you listen to the words, it ties right into this.
Well, I know, but it's kind of, this is a really old recording, so it's not the clearest thing in the world.
Did you go to that website that listener sent me to? Because it's much clearer on that website.
It is?
Yes.
This is the cleanest one I could find, but did you forward that to me?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Well, while you're talking, I'll look for it.
Hmm. I'm pretty sure I forwarded it. If not, I will. But I think it was Lone Star George who sent us that link, wasn't it? Or was it another listener?
I don't think it was Lone Star.
Might have been another gentleman. But I'm pretty sure I sent you that and told you to listen to the second verse of Underdog. But on that website, it's much, much clearer. Hmm. Okay, so I have three bad brokers this segment, our inaugural segment, to talk about. And what the heck
was
that?
Yeah, I listened to that one, and the one I have is just as good as that one.
So you did get it from the...
I think you're just remembering it differently.
Did you dive into that website?
I mean, dive into it. The theme song's right here on that link.
Oh. And it's no clearer?
No, not really.
You sure?
Mm-hmm. I'll listen to it again. Not now. Sorry to interrupt.
Okay, so... all three of these involved brokers, Chris, who were barred for life by the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. We're going to call them brokers because they are regulated by the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. FINRA regulates stockbrokers. And they're not really called stockbrokers anymore because now you can broker any number of items, not just stocks. You can broker bonds. You can broker private placements. You can broker business development corporations. You can broker non-traded REITs. There's a lot of things out there that brokers can now broker. So we're going to call them brokers. I think what will amaze you in this, Chris, two of the brokers who are barred for life, which is a pretty serious offense, you have to admit, for FINRA to...
For life.
Right.
Yeah, that's pretty severe.
So two of them didn't surprise me at all. The third guy who got barred, I really think he got the short end of a very long stick.
Hmm.
I think they gave him...
You feel sorry for one of these folks?
Yeah.
Punishment didn't fit the crime.
Yeah. On the third one, I don't think it fit the crime at all. If anything, he could have got reprimanded, smack on the wrist, maybe a letter of a letter where he did something wrong. And
admonition?
Admonition. Thank you. I got it.
Well, yeah, because you parroted back what I said.
It worked.
I guess, yeah. Try it again. How about now?
Admonition.
Nope, there it's gone already.
Admonition.
There you go.
I got it. Okay, so here's a broker who is barred for life.
Which means he can no longer sell securities legally.
Correct.
To the public.
Correct. And all of this is public information. If you go to a website called BrokerCheck, BrokerCheck is maintained by the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. If you go on any financial advisor's website, if that financial advisor or someone at that financial advisory firm maintains a registered rep designation, in other words, they maintain regulation under the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, FINRA now mandates that on that website, Chris, is a link to BrokerCheck. It will say, check the regulatory history of this or other brokers by clicking here, or something like that. And if you click there, it takes you directly to BrokerCheck. I'm not sure if it's BrokerCheck.com or BrokerCheck.org, but if you just Google BrokerCheck, that will take you to a website maintained by FINRA where you can type in the name and the state and city of the broker. And you will be able to read about any regulatory actions against said broker. So before you hire someone, or even if you're working with someone, we have that link on our website to check on me. There's nothing in my broker check. It'll say, yeah, Jim's been licensed in the industry since 99 or 2000, whatever it was, and no regulatory actions were taken or something to that effect. But all this information is public. So the article mentions these people by name. I think we can. We can at least call them by their first name. There's nothing wrong with mentioning the last name either. It's all public record. But I'm not going to name the major firms they're working for because these firms employ hundreds, if not thousands, of brokers. I don't want to disparage the firms because they have a few bad apples. So we're not going to name the firms. On the third one, I am going to name the firm only because you'll... It's just, I think he got the short end of the stick on this one. Because when you hear the firm, you're going to go, well, wait a minute, weren't they just in the news for doing something even worse?
Yeah.
Okay, so what this gentleman did, and it's to me, it's called churning. But what he did, there was an elderly client who had $308,000 invested with him. Mm-hmm. And between 2011 and 2015, the broker named Kelly Altar, A-L-T-H-A-R, is that Altar? Altar? Altar?
Hard to say.
All right.
Names are always a puzzle.
We'll call him Kelly.
Faux, foul, pafau.
Yeah, we'll call him Kelly.
Pafeu.
You done?
Yeah.
Okay. He did, in my, the technical term or the industry term, churning. Mm-hmm. Between 2011 and 2015, according to FINRA, and I quote, Mr. Althar, quote, engaged in high volume trading to generate commissions and over concentrated the client accounts in risky securities, despite the fact that the client was close to retirement and wanted low risk investments. That's essentially what churning is. Not so much concentrating the client in aggressive investments. The first part of what FINRA said, engaged in high volume trading to generate commissions. This gentleman on a $308,000 portfolio generated for himself, ready for this? $91,000 in commissions.
Oh my gosh. That's beyond excessive. I thought you were going to say $20,000 or $30,000.
$91,000.
$91,000. Oh, my goodness.
So what we're trying to warn listeners on, Chris, is churning. Why don't you talk a little about how can they notice that? What is churning?
Well, churning is where a advisor recommends and either encourages you to, or if you've given them the ability to trade within your account, they actually engage in trades, buys and sells of your investments, not really because there's any justifiable reason for doing so, but for purposes of what this person did, which is generating commissions on those sales, which of course is a drag on your investment portfolio. It's like paying really high fees, and talk about high fees. This person paid about 30% in fees. People complain about paying 1%. This poor person, this poor lady basically paid 30% in fees on this thing. So talk about a drag on their portfolio.
And when we come back, we'll review a couple of sample trades this gentleman did and then get into the two other cases where brokers were barred for life recently for doing nefarious things in the industry.
Perfect. So when we get back, we're going to hear the number one song this week back in 1982. We'll be right back with you on the Retirement and IRA Show.
Are you interested in your own customized Social Security analysis? If so, visit us at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and click the Contact Jim and Chris button. Jim and Chris offer a $75 Social Security optimization analysis that includes a one-hour consultation to discuss the specifics of your Social Security situation. This very affordable offer is for both singles and couples and will provide you with the information you need to make an informed decision about claiming your Social Security benefit.
Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. That's plenty of that song. In fact, the worst number one song of the entire decade of the 80s. Do you recognize it?
Sorry, I had my mic off. It's a movie, isn't it? I remember this being a movie.
Yeah.
I don't remember the movie.
This is terrible. This is like...
It's a running movie.
It's like Johnny just got a synthesizer for Christmas, so they do all this synthesizer music, and Johnny learned to play 8 bars of a tune on the piano over and over and over and over again.
What movie was this?
This is Chariots of Fire.
Didn't it have to do with running?
Yes, it had to do with the 1924 Olympics. But I think 24. Yeah, 1924 Olympics. Terrible. So I have to stop it. It's I personally despise that piece of music.
Worse than Kim Carnes? Because you were screaming over poor Kim Carnes.
That's a good one. But was and Kim Carnes was in the 80s, so that was still part of the 80s. I would listen to Betty Davis Eyes before I'd listen to that song.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. You heard that, yeah. Folks. So this is definitely in Chris, because he complained for like the 27 weeks that Kim Carnes was number one.
There's a bunch of versions of this. Here's a good one. A couple of the top names who have redone this fine, fine song, Zamfir on the pan flute, and Alvin and the Chipmunks
on the piano.
That's how quality this song is. Those are the people that are redoing it. Now, there are some others. John Williams. I have respect for John Williams. He did it with Boston Pops, but he was probably paid a lot of money to do it. That's okay. I'm praying that this does not go on long.
Well, we just won't play it anymore.
I won't play it anymore.
But the whole reason we do this, for those folks who don't know, if you remember, Chris led in with a song from 1935, and then he led in with a song from 40 years ago, and then this final song from 35 years ago. All of this ties into Social Security. That's why we do it. We host a blog called helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, and every week we like to give an update on what's new on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com by tying these songs in. 1935 was when Social Security was first created. When it was first created, they did a calculation based on 40 elapsed years, hence the reason why we look back 40 years. And today, they base your Social Security on a calculation using a number called 35 computation years, and that's why we look back 35 years. But all of this is a lead-in to what's new on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa! What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa.
So this week on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, I revisit, I guess, another way of thinking on a popular strategy that people can use when they're claiming Social Security. This applies to those people who can claim both a survivor's benefit because they're a widow or widower, and also have their own benefit to which they can claim. There are still strategies available involving those. There's some strategies have gone away that involved spousal benefits and your own benefit, but the survivor benefit, own benefit strategy still applies, where you can claim just your survivor benefit, letting your own benefit grow in the background, and then switch to it at some point in the future by age 70. There'd be never a reason to wait beyond that if you were going to switch. But today, or this week, I guess, on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, I discuss maybe considering undoing it. If you've decided to claim your social or your survivor benefit, there might be a case where it would make sense not to do that and actually switch to your own benefit instead. So it's really, I guess, a case study that you've got to look at the specific numbers that you're dealing with, and it might make perfect sense, especially in a low interest environment, to not do a certain strategy that a lot of people assume is going to work out for them. So I won't let the cat out of the bag on all the details, but that's what it involves. So if you have survivor benefits, if you have survived your spouse passing away and you have your own benefits, this would be a good one to listen to so that you can understand the full story and how you might weigh your options.
Okay.
Any questions?
No.
What's new, pussycat?
I always ask that, and I don't think you ever listen to me, so I don't think there's any questions ever.
Well, sometimes I ask you a question. Okay, so we were finishing up a new segment of ours, which mm-hmm. still doesn't have a easy flowing name. We should have thought of this name issue earlier.
Bad Visors. I like that one.
Bad Visors?
Mm-hmm.
All right, whatever. But it's just not. We're trying to tell you why these advisors got in trouble and what they were doing that was nefarious and how to protect yourself. And we talked about an advisor who had done a series of trades. He had a client with $308,000 in the account. And he did a series of trades on that account over the course of several years, according to the FINRA, Financial Industry Regulatory Authority complaint. He did this nefarious actions between 2011 and 2015. And What he did was a series of trades on a client account that generated for him $91,000 in commissions on a $300,000 portfolio. And FINRA lists an example of what he did. And they write, and this is from the article from the FINRA report. In December 2012, he purchased 700 shares of a real estate investment trust. A publicly traded real estate investment trust, Chris, not a non-traded REIT. So he could actually buy and sell it. Mm-hmm. So he bought 700 shares in December of 2012. He sold the shares 2 months later, and the client incurred a $261 loss. Mm-hmm. 2 months after that, he repurchased the same real estate investment trust, this time 800 shares. So he bought 700 shares, 2 months later sold them at a loss. Mm-hmm. 2 months after that, bought the same investment, but this time 100 shares more, 800.
Sounds like he can't make up his mind.
No. 6 weeks later, didn't even make it 2 months. 6 weeks later, he sold those for an $8,100 loss. So during that essential four-month period, the client lost $8,361 in investment losses. Right,
which didn't go to the broker in his defense, I guess.
Nope, the losses didn't. Nope. But what did go to him was $3,000 in commissions.
Hmm. By going in and out, in and out.
In and out, in and out, in and out.
Investment, yep.
And that is the definition, folks, of churning. How you can protect yourself from churning, if you have a broker, this is someone who's generating commissions on every trade. Now, the industry tries to deal with this one of two ways. You either form a relationship called an advisory relationship, so you don't have a brokerage relationship. You have an advisory relationship, and the advisor, he or she would pay you, or you would pay them rather, you would pay them usually a percent of your assets. We talked about this. The going rate is about 1% of assets to manage your portfolio. And a lot of times that will include all your trades and all of that. That's one option. But what if you just wanted to be a buy and hold investor, Chris? You don't want that active management. You don't need it. You can still have a brokerage relationship, but to protect you from churning, generating these sales commissions, just don't give your broker discretion. Take it away.
So they have discretionary agreements where you actually grant to the broker the ability to trade within your account without your permission, without your express commission or
permission.
You get to pay the commission, even though you didn't give permission. I would be reluctant to ever do that. Although, if you've engaged with them and you're encouraging them to actively trade your account, maybe you don't want a phone call every single time that they want to trade. Maybe you have a large portfolio and they're trading actively every week and you'd have to approve each one of those individually. That can be bothersome, but know the risk. When you provide discretion to your broker through this agreement that you'll make with them, you are giving them permission to do these trades without your express permission. And the temptation, if they're being paid, this is where a conflict of interest can come up. Paid by commission on trades, and they're the ones who decide when to trade, that's when you get that temptation of churning. Now, if they're compensated in another way, that would be a whole different issue. But a broker with discretion can be a very scary situation.
So anyways, that's the definition of churning. We have another example of that, probably, in my opinion, Chris, even more terrible than the one I just described. This one is a gentleman named Craig Dima, and he was a broker in New York. I'm not even going to pronounce the name of the town because there's no way that word is coming out of my mouth.
That's in your neck of the woods. You can't handle a northeastern name?
Ronkonkoma. Ronkonkoma?
Sure. I don't know. I'm not from that area.
Well, it looks...
We have simple names out here like Punkin Junction.
You don't have Ron Concoma?
No.
Okay, but anyways, Craig Dima, this is all public information from the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. You can look this up yourself on Broker Check. He did something even, it was churning, but I think if he didn't have discretion, none of this would have happened. He had a client with $15 million. Mm-hmm. She was 73 years old, and she was retired. And he, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority found that on 11 occasions, Mr. Dima sold virtually all of the client's holdings in Colgate-Palmolive. So the client had $15 million in Colgate-Palmolive. The client accumulated this stock over 28 years. And over the course of 11 days, Mr. Dima sold it all. Now, he said it was caused by a quote-unquote computer glitch. That was his defense. It was a computer glitch.
Really?
Yeah, well, I'm not saying it's a viable defense. I'm just saying.
The user of the computer had a glitch.
According to the article, when confronted by the client about the sales, Mr. Dima told her they were caused by a computer glitch. But he sold all Colgate-Palmolive. Mm-hmm. He generated for himself during the sale of this Colgate-Palmolive $375,000 in commissions and markups.
How much Colgate-Palmolive did this person own?
$15 million.
Holy, wow.
Weren't you paying attention?
No.
She had $15 million of Colgate-Palmolive.
And he was charging her the full 5%. Full boat on there.
Lord only knows. But wow. This computer glitch, which conveniently happened 11 separate times, this computer glitch, because it took 11 days to sell $15 million of Colgate-Palmolive, generated $375,000 in commissions and markups for Mr. Dima and cost the client $127,000 in dividends. So he was barred for life by FINRA. For this. That is also, I can't say it's churning in the traditional sense because he wasn't buying and selling. He was just selling.
Wow.
But he generated himself $375,000 in commissions. Now, if you took away discretion, he may not have been able to have sold that stock. It wasn't a computer glitch.
Could have happened either way.
Right. But the company he worked for, which I will not name, if it was a trading era computer glitch, would have made her whole.
Correct.
And put the dividends in and done everything. Mm-hmm. The fact that FINRA had to get involved and now I can guarantee you the firm is on the hook for all that. I can guarantee you FINRA awarded this woman all the commission, all the missed dividends, and probably punitive damages as well. So the firm that this broker worked for is on the hook for a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Same thing in the other case. Just so listeners know, all brokers have to work for a broker-dealer firm. Those firms, especially if they're big firms, have errors in omission insurance and deep pockets to pay these fines. Now, smaller broker-dealer houses, they sometimes go under and the investors get nothing. But you do have to watch out for that. So I think you would agree, Chris, those two people deserve to be barred for life.
I agree.
Okay. The third one. Now, I know you know the giveaway on the third one. The listeners
I've forgotten it now, though. I have a short memory.
I was really surprised, and I'm going to name the firm in this case because we have to. But here's what happened to Thomas James Stewart. Jimmy Stewart. Mm-hmm. Middle name, Jimmy. Okay. He is barred for life over what he did. Mr. Stewart was formerly a broker with blank. I'll name the company in a minute. And he used the firm's parking garage validation stamp without authorization to validate 50 of his parking stays in their garage between July 2015 and November 2015. So they were in a big building. Mm-hmm. They would validate parking for their customers.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Stewart would park in said garage and use his validation stamp to validate his own parking instead of paying for parking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the total dollars that he validated, the cost to his employer, $731.
Okay. Seems like a modest amount.
Now, the other people, one stole 375, not stole, but...
from a client.
$375,000 in churning commissions. Mm-hmm. The other one was $91,000 in churning
commissions. One of those folks stole from their...
Employer.
They was stole from clients, which is more outrageous.
Correct. And this guy, also what he did is he parked where he... in the garage, and mm-hmm. instead of paying the parking himself...
He validated it. Oh.
And he was caught. And the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority barred this man for life. The company he was working for, who he used their validation sticker on.
Before you say who it is, they clearly must have very high standards of ethical behavior expected from their employers or employees to outright. I'm sure they fired him too. He lost his license completely, barred for life. He can't be working in that industry anymore.
No.
So he's out. So they must be just have a stellar reputation to protect and hold people to the very highest standard.
Oh, absolutely. This firm would never do anything nefarious or wrong itself.
Well, they couldn't if they're holding their people to these.
Well, levels. They would. The firm, by the way, is Wells Fargo.
Oh.
The very company that opened millions of dollars of unauthorized credit cards and
the old cramming technique. A lot of people that work there must have worked for the phone companies back in the 1980s. Remember cramming, where they would sign you up for all kinds of things you didn't order hoping you didn't notice it
on the bill.
And there were companies that they weren't even offering any legitimate services. They intentionally just did that. And it was termed cramming. This is just the modern version of cramming, signing you up for a bunch of stuff that you didn't ask for in order to make some money off of you. And in this case, it was employees making bonuses and raises and things like that. That's just stellar. That's wow.
I think, again, in this case, I'm not trying to defend what this guy did. He stuck the parking bill to his employer.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he felt for some reason he was entitled to it. I'm working here. I should mm-hmm. be allowed to park here. I'm going to use my validation stamp and stick it
to... he should have done it.
But a lifetime bar for validating $731 worth of parking, even if it wasn't Wells Fargo, but it was Wells Fargo. Yeah. And they opened millions of dollars of unauthorized checking accounts and credit cards of their clients. I mean, that's all over the news. So I just thought that this was, wow, there's
some irony right
there. Irony right there. And I, though, also believe that FINRA overstepped the bounds. And you said maybe they did because perhaps the rules are tougher if you steal from the employer, the member firm. Remember, mm-hmm. FINRA is controlled by member firms. And so if you're a broker-dealer firm, you pay into FINRA, you're a member. So is there a rule that, hey, if you steal from a member, you're barred from life, but if you steal from an employer, from a client, maybe you won't be barred for life? I have seen other cases where people have done nefarious things against clients, not to the tune of the other two that we read, but still some pretty mean or dishonest things, Chris, and they were reprimanded and barred for 30, 60, 90, 180 days. This guy was barred for life. I don't know how good of a broker he was. Maybe he was terrible. Maybe he has other things. I didn't look him up.
But he'd have to have other, because this is FINRA that barred him. This isn't...
Wells Fargo fired him.
Being fired, that's a Wells Fargo thing. Who knows? Maybe he was a terrible employee that had a terrible record, and this was the last straw. But for FINRA then to lay on top of him, not only can you not do this work for Wells Fargo, you can never do this work for anyone anymore in the United States for the rest of your life. That's pretty harsh.
That's harsh. So there is no name to what he did except bad choice.
poor decision, whatever you want to call it, bad idea. Remember, that was the name of my Lima that I was going to get. Not my Lima, my Lima. Not my Lima. What the hell? Remember, I was going to get some sort of animal when I moved, and my mother, and we had a
lemur?
No, it was a Lima.
Oh, a llama.
Llama. Llama.
A Lima. What?
What a llama. Remember, I was going to buy a llama.
I thought you were going to get an alpaca. They're a lot nicer and small.
Well, when I first moved to the farm,
You were going to get a llama?
I was going to get a llama. Hmm. And remember on our radio show when we used to broadcast live from Greeley, we were having a call-in show
to of
named
llama?
Jim's Llama. And mom didn't call in. She texted.
Bad idea.
Bad idea. And she won.
I do remember that now.
Yeah,
that was good. So, that was the good old days.
But so whatever you want to call what this guy did, it was a bad idea. It was a poor choice. There's no way to protect yourself from someone validating parking that shouldn't be. I share this story only to put things in perspective. I have seen, and we will see as we continue with this segment, Chris, other brokers who might be reprimanded for 30, 60, 90, 180 days for things that were probably far worse against clients than stealing $731 of free parking validation. Your thought was because he did it against a member firm, maybe FINRA took a hard-lined approach. I mean, if this guy was arrested for shoplifting $731 of gum, do you think FINRA would have bought him for life?
I wouldn't think so, but they've got their standards, and I do think it has to do with stealing from the member firm itself. And maybe it's just any amount, or maybe it's a really low amount, like $100 or something. And he just happened to barely pass that threshold. I don't know what the rest of those details are, but a lifetime bar. There's certainly people that deserve it, and the first two would fall into that category in my book, as well as most of the others I've heard of. This is a strange one.
Exactly.
This is a strange one. So that music means we're at the end of another episode of the Retirement and IRA Show. Glad to have you back, Jim.
Glad to be back from
Chicago.
If anybody has questions, they can reach out to us. As always, go to our website, Jim Helps. That's Jim, HELPS.com. You can click the Contact Us button, or you can send me an email directly, Jim@JimHelps.com, and we will answer your question on a future show.
Perfect. So we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit JimHelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.